Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. Now, a bit of personal news, in case you hadn't already found out. This year, I am the president of the Chartered Institute of Logistics and Transport. I'm really grateful that the CILT invited me to be president this year. I'm looking forward to a busy and exciting year. If you're listening to this podcast, then you must be interested in transport, so you too should be a member. If you're not, please go across to CILT.org.uk and see all the benefits of being in membership at CILT. So my guest this episode is my great friend, Simon Calder. You've already seen or heard of Simon. He's on the radio, he's on the television, he's the travel correspondent for The Independent, and he has his own daily podcast series. I'm so excited that Simon found the time to come and join me. We started talking about just about everything. Well, Simon, I am an absolute daily avid fan of your travel podcast, the Independent Travel Podcast, which I enjoy enormously. Only thanks to you did I find the Southern Ridges Walk in Singapore, which I was following in your footsteps, I think, about 10 days later, which is tremendous. And all the things you tell us about the rail strikes and what's happening on the bus services, what's going on in airports, some of the tips, and especially most recently, the one I listened to about being on your guard for travel fraud. So I found it enormously useful. I hope you have thousands of listeners. Is that right?
First of all, your feedback is hugely appreciated. And thank you for that. It's good to know when one is sort of on the right track. And secondly, no, my sole purpose is to hopefully to inform and explain and now and again, maybe even to entertain. But all I can do is sort of do that to the best of my ability and then just hope that maybe somebody notices. But I'm not a great person in terms of calculating audiences and all this stuff. So I just do what I've always done and hope that it gets picked up.
I'm in great awe, Simon, because I do these episodes every 2 to 3 weeks and I fiddle about and knock them into shape. But you manage to do the whole thing off the cuff, sometimes on your phone in the immigration queue or in the check-in queue or something. So I'm in great awe. And I'm also in great awe because you find several minutes of material every day, which is a huge thing. So I'm just fascinated. There's news every day. That's amazing.
Well, I mean, the travel world, I guess, a bit like the political world, just seems to be accelerating. You know, there's just so much stuff to talk about. I've never, ever thought, what am I going to tell Leon about today? It's just, you know, it's literally, of all the many, many things that are happening in the world, what's most important? And obviously also I do get through various channels, lots of questions about, for example, you know, what happens when my luggage is lost? You know, can I change the name on a plane ticket and stuff like that? Where you're just sort of hopefully performing a useful public service, just telling people what the score is.
I tell you what I found transformational on my journeys. I got 3 or 4 of these little GPS tags that you can get. I have one in my suitcase and one in my briefcase and so on. There is nothing nicer when you land at a foreign destination and you start to wonder whether your suitcase made it, for it to go ping and to let you know it's in the same country and is in the same town as you are. Because then you stand by the luggage conveyor, relaxed, not peering into the distance to see if yours is going to be the last one off.
There is something actually better than that, Leon. And that is knowing that you have everything in your cabin baggage and that I will bid you a cheery farewell as I stride off to discover whichever city I'm lucky enough to have landed in while you're still waiting. And you might know it's there, but even if you knew it was in South Africa rather than Singapore, the fact that you knew that, I mean, I suppose, you know, information is power and that would help, but it's not going to accelerate the process of it getting back to you, I fear. So just take everything you can. If you can't manage it with cabin baggage, you're probably taking too much stuff.
Oh, well, there's a good piece of advice. Thank you, Simon. I've got another journey to do in February. And I will take your advice and I will try and cram, including my camera, I will try and cram it all into my cabin bag and try that, because I think collecting your baggage at an airport is probably the most stressful part of the journey once you've got checked in. I think from that moment on.
I'd say the security searches you might recall a podcast where I described the astonishing experience I had at Gatwick going out to Egypt a few weeks ago, where I managed to get in the right queue for one of the new pieces of kit. And I was just about to drink my half litre of water, as I always do, and I know exactly where I'm going to fill it up, the other side of security. And the guy just said, no, it's fine, just leave your liquid, it's fine. You don't need to take your bag of stuff out of the bag and have it separately, and you don't need to take your laptop out. So this was all marvelous. That's the most stressful thing, I think. But, you know, even on the scale of things, even when I came back through Hurghada, and I think there were 10 separate checks between the airport road, where they want to know that you're a proper passenger, to finally allowing you onto the EasyJet flight. Yeah, 3 hours of unnecessary mess, including the the guy whose job it was immediately after the security check to check that you've been through the security check, if you see what I mean. You weren't even going to get to see him unless you'd been through the security check, but that was his job. There we are. Anyway.
The other stressful one I had was last year, actually. It was a domestic flight in India, and I had put my bag on in security, and it got tugged in order to be inspected. But in front of me was a family of about 12, all of whom had cabin bags, all of whom got selected for inspection, and all 12 of whose keys were with somebody else.
Brilliant.
So I am behind a family of 12 with locked cabin baggage.
Yes.
And I thought I had plenty of time. And you can imagine what a family of 12 people traveling domestically in India is capable of, the sort of noise and fuss they're capable of making, until eventually the security man decided he'd had enough and walked off. So I'm now looking at my cabin baggage. So may everybody be spared from that.
I need to know how that was resolved.
Eventually they were all broken open and inspected.
You carry a jemmy for just such occasions.
Unbelievable. But I'm fascinated about machines. I go through Schiphol quite a bit, and they've had liquids and computers, laptops and things all inside your bags for a little while now. It's immensely efficient. I thought I'd read London City was the first place to get it in UK, but you clearly had it at Gatwick.
Yeah, I it was the first time I have been explicitly through it. Now, Heathrow's got some, other airports are obviously getting some, because you've got to get the kit in, which is very expensive, and you've got to get people trained on it. But of course, the problem that everybody worries about is that you go through London City or Schiphol or Gatwick or wherever, and you assume that it's always going to be like that forever. And then suddenly it isn't. And that's always been the problem with airport security, although there are some who say, actually, we need to randomize airport security much more, so that sometimes you're just way through. You know, we are looking at, you know, we're watching you as you walk through. But yeah, we know that 99% of people have no evil intent. They just want to get on their holidays or get to their business trip or go and see their family or whatever. So, you know, rather than spending a great deal of theatrical time examining all their stuff, actually, we are going to one day wave you right through. Then the next day, we're going to go through absolutely everything. And you won't know which it is. Whereas any, and I'm sorry to say, this is, you know, what the secret of 9/11 was, that they knew exactly what they would be able to get through security. And, you know, it was so prescriptive and box ticking that they managed to get through with blades and cause utter mayhem. And so therefore, rather than just, okay, we will tell everybody precisely what they need to do, having some randomness is arguably a good thing.
No, for sure. Well, look, isn't it nice to be traveling? Isn't it nice that we can now go to places, even China?
Only if you've got an invitation and stuff for China. Hong Kong you can get into, and you just need a lateral flow test in the 24 hours before you go. So it's all good, yes.
So for China, then, it's still really only for business, not for tourism?
Yeah, they're not interested in tourism yet. I mean, they were always, considering the size of the country, they were always a relatively small player. So you've got kind of the big tourism countries who are basically the United States, Italy, France, and they're always kind of smaller than that anyway, and obviously being a much faster country. So, no, I mean, they're really important to the outbound tourism industry, but they can do without it. And the other thing, and I don't know how much you paid for your flight to East Asia, but the absence of Chinese airlines from the, and I'm not saying this in the pejorative sense, from the bottom of the market is absolutely palpable. Because before, if you wanted to get to Bangkok for absolute bargain basement fare, if you needed to get to Sydney and you simply couldn't pay £1,000, you could always get fly with China, Eastern China, Southern, Air China, via one of their hubs, and you would be able to get there. It wouldn't be, premier class experience, and you have to wait around and stuff, but it would be interesting enough, of course, and you pay a reasonable fare. And without them and the capacity that they offered and the fares that they charged, at the moment, people are paying an awful lot more than they were before the pandemic.
Yes, indeed. Well, I've always taken your advice, which is that on the very long haul, doing the journey in two bits is often more enjoyable and, of course, also cheaper. So my favorite route to the Far East is always on Qatar via Doha. And that's particularly because, of course, Qatar is in one world. So you're getting British Airways one world points and miles traveling on a very, very nice airline. But as you say, you could go obviously on Chinese airlines and break that journey really very well. And the other one that's nice to do, of course, I love going on Emirates. If you fly on Emirates by booking through Qantas, even though Emirates is not in one world, Qantas is. So you can be getting one world privileges by traveling on Emirates by doing the code share with Qantas. So that's Leon's tip for one world points scoring.
Well, you're in a different realm to me, Leon, because I'm when I buy a flight through British Airways or Qatar Airways or British Airways on a Qatar, they give me 3¼ Avios because I'm always paying the least possible. But good luck to you and everyone else who is able to work the system to their advantage.
Thank you. And talk about working the system. I think now apps and AI generally is helping us with our rail fares, isn't it? Because what I was always fascinated about in TfL with Oyster is that you give the system enough money to clean out your bank account by tapping on and tapping out. And you are satisfied, aren't you, that at the end of the day, the system will tot it all up and give you the best price for the day. Whereas if you went to a human at a railway station, you always came away feeling that you weren't quite sure whether you got the best deal or not. And I'm fascinated that people on the one hand will give all their bank details to an organization like TfL and trust it, but don't necessarily trust the human. Whereas now with apps as well, everything from split tickets, which I find hugely useful, and the fact that you can do these sort of what ifs so that you do know if you go 20 minutes later or 30 minutes later, you might save another £4 or £5 or so on. And I think that is just remarkable because we trust the apps to give us the best deal. And then all we do is hold our phone up to the reader or the show the barcode and we're on our way. I think that's great.
Yeah. Well, but the whole fare system in the UK needs to be overturned. It is to the enduring shame of, well, every government since privatisation that they've allowed the fares to become more and more anomalous and utterly random. And yes, as you say, I mean, if you go back 20 years, there was a cohort of us who knew about the Didcot Dodge, well known that it even got its own nickname. This is the fact that between London and Bristol, so a really important route, all you need to do is make sure you're on a train which stops at Didcot, which almost all of them do, and you can halve the fare just about by buying one ticket to Didcot and another one from there. Now, there are many, many other savings that can be made elsewhere. And the great thing about apps such as Trainline is that they are automatically looking for them for you, which brings it into the mainstream. And it means that that this is undermining in a good disruptive way the old certainties of revenue on the railway. Because if the majority of people travelling between London and Bristol are doing the Didcot Dodge because Trainline's told them to, that's the more that happens, the faster the whichever government it is will actually do what they all know has to be done, which is to rationalise the whole fare system and to remove all these anomalies that were kind of started in privatisation as a kind of way of protecting the public. But now all they're doing is confusing the public.
Yeah. So I once, Simon, had the chance to ask Stelios EasyJet. He was giving a lunchtime talk questions. I put my hand up and I said, look, everybody on the EasyJet flight pays a different fare. When we do that on the railways, it's front page on the Daily Express that says crisis on the railways, 100 fares to Manchester. Why do they love you and hate me so much? So he said, well, I'm younger, richer and better looking. Then yeah. He said he thinks anybody that brings cheap airfares to the public will always be a special sort of hero, like Freddie Laker.
Yeah.
Then he went for the jugular. Then he said, the trouble with you people in public transport is on railways, you do market segmentation by height. And I said, what does that mean? He said, well, fares for adults, fares for children, fares for two adults and one child, one adult and two children, one adult, one child, one dog. He said, on EasyJet, there's only one fare per day, and it may go up or down depending on how many we've got to sell. But in the same way Tesco's does not sell half-price bread to children, we do not sell half-price tickets either. Old people, he said, looking at me, thank you, travel cheaply on EasyJet, not because they're old, but because they book a long time in advance. And he said, it'll be very hard to rationalize rail fares for as long as you are trying to batch these up into combinations of adults and children and dogs and old age pensioners and business, most of it.
Yeah.
Because it multiplies up several fold the numbers of options that there are. And simplicity is the answer, he said.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sure. The trouble is that the railways are trying to do lots of things. But if you take absolutely the London-Edinburgh City pair, which was his second route after London-Glasgow, where you have Lumo, which is a no-frills train service, and they are up against EasyJet, as well as British Airways, and actually probably quite soon Ryanair as well. And they are just on this main, you know, the leading domestic air route, and that is who they are competing against. And yet even this new startup coming in, £100 million investment, absolutely fantastic. I travel on it all the time because it's generally, you know, the best way to get between the two cities. And they've either decided to or they've agreed to under protest, but either way, I don't think it should have happened. They have to give railcar discounts. How can you manage a business if you're saying, oh, well, Leon, he might only look 32, but actually he's old enough to have a senior rail card, and therefore we have to give him one third off. Whereas, this 59-year-old lady, obviously we're not going to give her any discount. It increases complexity. It is absolutely boggling. I kind of despair. I talked to the managing director when they brought it in, so I was just assuming, you know, that they would be saying, no, we're competing with the airlines, therefore we're competing on their terms. But no, Lumo was slotting in to the whole kind of arcane railway business. And because, it does a little bit between Edinburgh and Morpeth and Newcastle and so on. But actually, it is an intercity operator in competition with the airlines, and it should be able to behave like that rather than giving you a discount and messing up all the benefits of dynamic pricing, which EasyJet exercised so well.
I couldn't agree more. Of course, Martin Gilbert now in charge at Lumo, so he's an entrepreneurial busman, if ever there was one, of course. I have great hopes for Lumo, because under Martin's a great retailer. You know, he's all over revenue and squeezing more revenue out of the system. I think Lumo is an excellent example, actually, of what we should be doing. But as you say, we should do even more than that. It's shackled by just as you describe. In rail terms now, of course, there's nothing in it for the train operating companies on the franchise network, is there? They're on a management contract. And if you ring them up and say, look, I've got this big tourist attraction, can we have a two-for-one deal? They'll say, nothing to do with us anymore.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, we can argue about the extent to which you have the doubling of passenger numbers between privatization and the start of the pandemic, and the extent to which that was because of privatization or despite privatization or somewhere between the two. But certainly there has been innovation among the train operators where they are taking revenue risk and where they are incentivized to extract it. But at the moment, it is being run by the dead hand of the civil service. And yes, you're getting still some innovation, ironically, from two of the operators of last resort. So that's Northern and it's LNER, who are, you know, Northern saying fares for 50 pence. And if anything is going to stimulate demand, that is. And, you know, people who are just making one trip think, oh, actually, yeah, the train's much better than they were. No Pacers anymore. There's Wi-Fi. It's comfortable. Nice scenery, relaxed and so on. And LNER, who I think have been absolutely commercially focused in a way that actually was kind of a mark of the best of British Rail. a nationalized enterprise, but one that is very, very much focused on delivering good service at a fair price and, crucially, building ridership.
Yeah, and also LNER is a very good example of where they were upselling, weren't they? The catering was good. The drinks were good. You felt like you were being well treated. So you probably spent a little bit more. You probably had extra cup of coffee. You had a egg and chips or whatever. I mean, I think they did a really good job at that.
Yeah. But of course, let's look at what LNER also has to do. So it's not just a very good intercity operator to Leeds, to Lincoln when there isn't a strike on. Obviously, the main core route to York, Newcastle, and so on. But it's also having to shuttle people between Darlington and Durham. And that's fine and good, but it's very messy from the point of view of, you know, what is LNER's purpose, whereas it's very easy to say what EasyJet's purpose is, which is to provide safe transportation at a decent fare and a good return to their shareholders. It gets an awful lot more complicated than that, when you are stopping at Darlington and Durham, and people perfectly reasonably want to be transported between the two, and that's on a train whose job is to go from London to Aberdeen.
Leon Daniels is talking to Simon Calder, the travel correspondent of The Independent, and much-traveled travel expert. He has his own daily show. Link to Simon Calder's Independent Travel Podcast wherever you get your podcasts from.
We won't get political, but of course you very helpfully got us through the details of the strikes and helped us think about what's working and what's not working and what it means for us and so on. But without being political, I'm a bit irritated by some of the media attention, which is, don't you think the rail workers should have a pay rise? Because it's not the right question. The right question is, are you prepared to pay higher fares and possibly higher taxes so the rail workers can have a pay rise? That's a really different question, because I think we would all vote to have a pay rise. But if there's an implication for us, I think we would have a more measured response. And I hear this news, and you'll have heard it too. There's a lot of noise about rail fares being affordable, but actually rail fares are also supposed to reflect the cost of running the railway.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things on the railway that are very expensive, and rolling stock is very expensive. And when we're talking about several million pounds a mile for track, then it's not surprising we're not able to offer fares for 50p as much as we like, nor are we able to give unlimited rises to rail workers.
Rail unions have done very, very well by their members, I would say, since privatisation, in terms of overall, my understanding from the research I've seen, and this has come from the employer's side, so therefore I need to make that caveat, that relative to inflation, relative to wage increases, they have done better. Now, I think if you look across the whole public sector piece, and clearly the vast majority of rail workers are effectively public service employees, there does seem to be a very, very large shortage in the NHS of tens of thousands of people who I think could be incentivized to work there for significant amount of extra money. And I know that at the bottom end, entry level of the railways, there's some shortages, and it's difficult in a tight labour market to do that. But actually, you're not getting vast numbers of people leaving the railways, because I think, relatively speaking, it is well rewarded. And I need to say that Mick Whelan, the ASLEF union train drivers leader, says that his members are not relatively well rewarded, but one can discuss that. Having achieved, you know, through their industrial muscle, some very good results and shrewd negotiation, these things are all agreed by the employers, I am concerned that they are now pushing their luck. There is this sense, and I think it was actually one of the TSSA union leaders who said, you know, the railways are essential. Well, they kind of are and they kind of aren't. For an awful lot of passengers and for a lot of freight, there could be in extremis alternatives. And actually, I think that the network rail map that gets put out every time there's a strike by the RMT involving network rail kind of shows you the future, if you were going to look at it in that terms, which is the key intercity links and the main suburban networks around the big cities have trains. Nothing in Cornwall, nothing going to Lincoln, Stoke-on-Trent's cut off because actually everything's going through Crewe. And you can kind of see that we could become like the Americans and just pare back. And of course, you will be more familiar than I am with this whole spiral of decline where fewer people are using the railways because they are frankly non-resilient. And at the moment, nobody can plan anything more than 2 weeks ahead because they don't know when a strike is going to be happening. And I just fret that, well, it is well known, and I've just actually been reading a study conducted in Montreal in 2018, that when you have serious disruption in the medium term, then you get permanent changes to some people's travel patterns, and that ultimately is probably going to mean that they're not going to be using those transport services. And yes, you can keep pushing, you can keep saying we're essential, and you've got, yeah, we know they're going to settle and so on, but ultimately this is eroding confidence in the railways just at the time when there's one thing that we need, it's confidence in railways and more widely public transport.
COVID did teach us a lesson there, because COVID did teach us how to not have to commute so much or travel so much. I'm not advocating it, by the way. I don't think we should all sit at home and look at our screens all day. And we are both advocates of it. Getting out there into the fresh air and traveling is a wonderful, rewarding experience. I am surprised that in the aftermath of COVID, where, let's face it, nobody in transport knew whether they had a job to go back to or not, and where we've got ridership back in the sort of 85 to 90% type numbers, this is a time to encourage, to give people every possible reason to travel if they need to or want to. And I would agree with you that continually disrupting it just gets you to think about the alternative, which is anywhere between the car, the coach, the video link. And if we thought long and hard about it, the best interests of the rail workers is to make sure there are as many jobs as possible for as long as possible. This is damaging the railways in a way that will have long-term consequences. And I'm sorry about that, frankly.
But look, looking on the positive side, people are discovering, for example, long-distance coaches, and they're suddenly realising, oh, hang on, that journey I made in 1983 on National Express, calling it all stations, things have changed a bit, and I've now got Wi-Fi, and I can plug in my laptop and my phone, and it's leather seats, and we're going non-stop. And yeah, it's taking 50% longer than the train, but it's costing 50% less than the train. And how marvellous that we've got great competition between National Express and Megabus and Flixbus.
Yes. And also, of course, in some of the case of journey origin and destination pairs, if you look at, for example, the journey by coach from, let's say, the University of the West of England on the outskirts of Bristol.
It is beyond Narnia of my mental map.
There has been in the past a direct coach service from the housing estates on the outskirts of Leicester into London. Whereas if you compare the actual time of getting from the suburbs of Leicester to the railway station, then waiting and getting a train in London and getting off and so on, the journey time benefit is actually significantly eroded. And coach can do some point-to-point journeys in quite respectable time. And frankly, of course, those journeys include down to the West Country, where you're nonstop on the motorway for considerable distances, whereas the railway is doing some meandering as it's making some of those journeys. So no, I think it is getting people to think more seriously about alternatives. And I just hope that when all this is over and people are back to work, I do just hope that they've now got enough demand in order to justify all of those people working on the railway, because that would be an own goal otherwise.
But Leon, for goodness sake, you know all about managing big organisations and the importance of getting your staff absolutely on side. And yet every aspect of the current industrial climate on the railway seems to be, well, there's only one word for it, and that's toxic. And I'm really, really worried. You know, so, for example, TransPennine Express. Many, many, many on-the-day cancellations still, and that is happening because they're saying, there's a training backlog because COVID. Yeah, I'm not sure how long that excuse will be able to pertain for, but they're also saying higher than usual levels of sickness, and that, I would suggest, is symptomatic of people, you know, if they wake up and they've got a bit of a sniff and a cough, I think the technical term is can't be asked to go to work. And and once you're into that territory, you've got yet more disruption, passengers more and more cheesed off, less appeal going to the to work. And again, it's this horrible spiral.
I know.
How do we get past that then?
I'm one of those people who was brought up that what you were supposed to do in life was go to work. And you got yourself a job.
there were things about, if there were things about the job you didn't like, then you either found another job, or if you couldn't, you stuck with it. So I start from that end of the scale, which is we normally should go to work, earn money, feed our families, go on holiday, pay the mortgage, and have your dinner. And rail is one of those jobs. And of course, you know, there's lots of different jobs in rail, from catering to track work to driving to tickets and so on. On the face of it, it looks reasonably well rewarded to me. And whilst some of the shift work must be very unpalatable, and some of the work out in the cold and the dark's not very good, by comparison with people who work on highways, people who work on motorways, people who work in healthcare and so on, I don't think it's bad. So I'm afraid I subscribe to the view that a small increase is justified just to keep pace with the cost of living and so on. But given there are lots of benefits, including pensions and travel concessions and a whole series of things like that, my line would be to the rail industry, and I expect I'm going to get quoted for this: cash in now, go back to work, say thank you, work hard, help get more passengers, grow the revenue, and come back for some more when things have improved.
But I think this involves you and I kind of almost revealing our average age. So you're now in your late 30s, I think. So we are from a different time, and there is very much the idea prevailing that the railways are essential, and there is a magic money tree, and if you just keep on striking, then you are going to get more cash. But it makes me despondent. I've never had a car. I've always depended on the railways. And now, well, I made the fantastic discovery when I came into Gatwick on a rail strike day of Morden. And I hadn't realised how Morden in southwest London, the deep south of the tube network, actually opens up the entire quadrant of the southwest of the capital. It's got fantastic links. It's got buses. You walk a little while, you've got the fantastic tram. And this is one of those beneficial discoveries you get from disruption. But that's really good for my future exploration in Norbiton and Kingston and Rains Park and New Malden and everything. But getting to the other side of the UK is not going to be that good.
So Simon, then just before we finish, I have to ask you, because I know my listeners will want to know, what's your favourite rail journey in this country?
Well, it's actually very difficult to not make it one in Scotland, because there are so many magnificent ones. I probably think, actually, Ayr to Stranraer in the far southwest. Extraordinary, like the West Highland Line, which is much, much better known, goes through places which cars can't reach. Also incredibly inefficient, and it sums up exactly what's wrong with the railway. It's run on tokens. This is 2023, and there is still this bag containing a token that ceremonially four times, I think, during the journey gets handed from one person to another. And the whole thing is mad and incredibly expensive, and it must lose an absolute fortune, but at the same time, it's very beautiful.
Well, that's amazing. Next time I'm at some global transport conference and they're talking to me about digital signalling, I'll remember about Ayr to Stranraer and the tokens and so on. And have you got a favourite journey by water as well?
Oh, well, in the UK, I would need to say, actually, I like the Isle of Wight ferries, even though they are incredibly expensive. And that is, my goodness me, if we've got transport disruptors out there, please do something about the Solent. I think the most expensive water in the world. Yeah, when you're paying £200 return for a 20-minute journey to take your car between Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, there's something wrong with that, and we need to sort that out, although it is very lovely when you're on board.
I was very disappointed when the last time I went to the Isle of Wight, and I was booking my journey to the Isle of Wight on the South West Railway app. I happened to want to go on the hovercraft, but it kept on putting me on the ferry. And if I tried to get on the hovercraft, even if I forced it, it put me on the ferry. And I discovered the reason is, of course, is that Southwest Railways get a better level of commission from the ferries than they do from the hovercraft operator. Now, I take great exception to that, because if I am using an app in order to give me an optimized journey experience, I expect it to be optimized for me, not optimized for the commission of the person who's providing the service. And then I've got to ask you, Simon, from me, of course, your favorite bus journey.
Well, it's one of yours, or it used to be one of yours, and it is the number 11, which is absolutely, for £1.65, the greatest sightseeing tour, running effectively from London Liverpool Street Station, down through the city, along the Strand, Trafalgar Square, Westminster, everywhere. And of course, it is the route which is going to be axed, or rather diverted to Waterloo, where it will miss all of the above. But that's progress, and I'm sure it wouldn't have happened in your day.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Look, I've had so much fun today. My guest has been Simon Calder, transport correspondent for The Independent, and of course, the author, if that's what you are, of a podcast, The Independent Traveller Podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts from. And I'm really thrilled and honoured that Simon, who goes on air every day with his podcast, has found half an hour to come and talk to me at Lunch with Leon, which is an ITT Hub production. Please go to our website at itthub.co.uk. Find out all the details of our wonderful show at Farnborough this spring, where we bring together the manufacturers of vehicles, the data handlers, the disruptors, and the energy providers for everything we need to do about running any sort of transport business in this century. In the meantime, Simon, thanks very much indeed.
Absolute pleasure. And I hope that 2023 turns out to be a year of miracles for you and your lovely listeners.